We're beginning with Mishpatim, that's in chapter 21 in Shemos. The Eilah HaMishpatim Asher Tosim Lufneihem. And these are the Mishpatim that you shall place before them. So, of course, the first question that we need to ask is, what exactly do we mean by Mishpatim? Mishpatim are commonly translated as judgments. But we can't just use a word. We have to try and get a sense of what it means. What's unique, what's specific about Mishpatim? Mishpatim. So it's very clear from the Mefarshim that there's no doubt about it, and from what follows, that it's referring to a particular aspect of halacha. Those things that have to do with Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, relations between people. And that area which would be known as judgments, civil laws, damages. It's not limited only to damages, but it governs our behavior with regard to how we're supposed to treat other people with justice, the area which is known as justice. Take a look at Rashi, for example. Comments on the juxtaposition. The last subject in Yisro, the preceding Sedra, had to do with the building of the Mizbeach. The Mizbeach of Avonim Tasali, going back now to chapter 20, Pasuk 22, and if you build a Mizbeach, an altar of stones, Lo Sivna Es En Gozes, you shall not build it with hewn stones, that's cutting. You're not allowed to cut the stones. Because once you lift your sword over it, so you nullify it. Alright, so that's an interesting idea, the sword. What's going on over there? Then it says, Lo Salav Amalos Al Mizbechi, that you're not allowed to go up with the steps on the up to the altar. Ashalosi gola ervaschalav, that you should not reveal your nakedness on it. So let's just take a look at this idea in passing about building a ramp. That the Mizbeach, the altar, has a ramp instead of steps, so that as a person walks up, they shouldn't, so to speak, like spreading of the legs, the sort of revealing of the nakedness, the sexual organ. So Rashi makes a comment that shall yidei hamaylos, because if you have steps, at the tzarech laharchiv psiosecha, so you have to take bigger steps, wider steps. V'af al pi she'eino giloy erev hamamash, and even though in reality, even if you were to do that, that would not be anything untoward. There'd be no nakedness. Shereik Siv, because it says, Vaseilucham Michnasevad, that they had to make linen pants, in describing the special clothing that the Kohanim wore. So, if that's the case, then there's no problem. Nevertheless, Rashi says, Mikol Makom Harchavas Apsios, nevertheless, taking bigger steps, Karov Legiloi Ervaho, it is close to that. Related to that. Rashi continues, V'ata noeg behem minog bizoyon. And thus you are conducting yourself in a disrespectful, easily disparaging manner towards the Mizbeach. V'areid zvorim kal v'chomer. Then Rashi takes it to the next level. You can learn a lesson and apply it to a different arena. Uma avonim halalu, and if these stones, she'ein behem das lahakpid al bizyonon, which are not, don't have any knowledge, don't have any awareness, you're not hurting them in a real sense. Whatever you do, you can do the most degrading kind of an activity, and they're not going to be upset by it because you're not really hurting anybody. No, it's inanimate. Amra Torah, the Torah said, called the Yeshbehem Tzorech, since there is a need for them, they have a purpose. Lo tinag behem minag bizayon. You should not behave towards them in a degrading manner. If that's the case, chavercha, your fellow, shehu bedmus yotzrecha, who is in the image of your yotzer, as a soul, divine soul, umakpid al bizayono, and is affected by your degrading him. He's concerned. He's makbid. He's demanding with regard to his own embarrassment. Allah has come from a how much more so? On the surface, it's very difficult to comprehend. Many, many questions arise here. It's not at all clear what exactly is this minhag bizayon, this degrading, treating it in a degrading way by the utilization of steps. And we've raised the question, if that's the case, you shouldn't have steps anywhere. Nobody seems to associate that. Going up steps, it's true, and you may have to take wider steps, or shorter steps. It doesn't seem to be associated with what we would call loose behavior, unseemly conduct. Then there's this idea of the kal v'chomer, that we can learn something from this, that if the Torah is so demanding concerning the degradation of the stones, which in effect don't really care because they're inanimate, how much more so should you be careful not to disparage your fellow man who is created in the image of God and who is demanding, who is mocked concerning their own honor, that you shouldn't degrade another person. So that's really what you learn out from here. You learn that from here. How many, that's the kal v'chomer. The kal v'chomer is how much more so? You would say. That is to say, of the two, which is worse? To act in a manner which is not sufficiently respectful of the mizbeach, or to act in a manner which is not sufficiently respectful to a fellow human being? Most people would say, you see that there is a disconnect. We can understand why this is important, why the idea is important, even if you don't see all the steps here. If you were to ask people, perhaps they'd agree, but in terms of actual behavior, what does the behavior of people reflect? People would act in a manner which is just the opposite. That is, they have a tremendous awe for a holy place. So when they go to the Kotel or the Mara Samach Pela and so forth, most people will behave with a certain awe. And if a person is frivolous, they'll rebuke them. However, when it comes to dealing with other people, they won't show the same type of an awe. Unless they're perfected. But in general, there are more people that have this awe for a place will not necessarily follow through and have the same attitude towards another person. That's not holy. It's just an ordinary person. So their attitude will be contradictory to this truth that's being expressed here. Another basic issue is that Rashi's raised the biggest question, that in fact there is no Gilui Erva, because they wore pants. So taking big steps wouldn't create any kind of a degradation. But Rashi is saying that it's close. Nevertheless, he's saying the Archavas Apsios, taking big steps, is close to Gilui Erva. But we have to try to understand what that means. Again, the difficulty is, if we're going to say that there is a reality to this, that it is, it's kind of a loose, it's a loose way of behaving. Now we can understand there are certain ways that a person would behave at home or with friends. You know, you don't have to display the same type of reverential seriousness when you're at home. You could discuss certain things, but those things shouldn't be discussed in the shul, the holy place. You act differently, you Torah, you dress differently. So that we understand. The question is whether this type of a concept of not walking on steps, is there a reality to that? That indeed is a looser behavior, a looser form of behavior, having to do with something seriousness, a breach in modesty. Is that a breach in modesty? If that's the case, why is it only showing up in the Mikdash? Why shouldn't it be in other situations? And even if you say, well, the Torah didn't mandate that every house has to be built with ramps instead of stairways, but still, that should be some kind of an ideal. That is, to begin with, if a person doesn't have to build steps, they should go build ramps. I've never heard of that idea anyways. I don't know if anyone's heard of that concept. The question we're debating is whether the prohibition against steps is because that there's a certain reality. The actual walking up the steps would have an effect upon the person on an emotional level, whether consciously or unconsciously, and would arouse a sort of the sexual part of the person, whether that's the thing. Why not? Not at all. From a practical standpoint, it doesn't really make a difference, but this law was placed there in order to drive home a certain point, to function as a reminder to the person. Those are the two possibilities that we're considering. Before we go further, I want to make the point that it is a significant issue in a general sense. The separation between the religious aspect of a person and the instinctual aspect of a person is something to consider. Most people regard the two as being completely separate. However, if you're talking not in terms of Judaism, because Judaism is not the expression of the religious instinct in man, to the contrary, it is the uprooting of the religious instinct in man and replacing it with divine wisdom, with chachma. It's how to relate to God in terms of truth, in terms of knowledge, not in terms of the dictates of the religious instinct in man. That is a very significant point. All the other religions in the world are rooted in, based upon, and designed to satisfy the religious instinct in man, in the human. It's a natural instinct. And when that is the case, you will see that this so-called religious instinct is not as sublime and pure and separated from the sensual as people make it out to be. To the contrary, it's really rooted in the sensual. That's why you'll have so many stories about so-called religious people, very charismatic ones. Famous book and movie, Elmer Gantry. I don't know if anybody's heard about that. This whole theme of highly charismatic preachers that get really very worked up. When you see that, there's a good example of the point that was made before, that sometimes a person gets in a heightened state of religious sensitivity, and this is an instinctual, phenomenon. That's not what Yahadus is intended to be. Judaism does not advocate that, to the contrary. But religion in general, to the extent that you see people getting very, very worked up, they're getting worked up in an instinctual kind of a way. I'm not going through all the different religions or the different denominations, but you'll see that sometimes on TV, you flip through, you see that they have these services, and people are singing and praising and getting so very excited. It's very, very intense. Instinctually and emotionally, and then all the music. A lot of these services you could listen to, and if you didn't know it was a religious thing, you could think it's a rock concert. It's jumping and dancing and let loose and all that, and and everybody, well, because it's for religious content, so they think it's religious, but it's a very emotional, very instinctual kind of an experience. See, Yahadus doesn't have that type of a thing. Does not believe in opening up the doors to all of the instincts and allowing a person to just vent his emotions in the service of God. Judaism is completely against this whole approach, that the underlying emotional desire with regard to God and how to relate to God should be the driving force. That's always rooted in the instinctual, and it's always related to idolatry. It's an idolatrous phenomenon. It's a desire to just gratify a certain instinct in man. The role of the emotion is, as a result, the emotion is very, very important, because a person is an emotional being, and if the person is in line with the truth, with the good, through the appropriate manner, So then it should have a very powerful emotional impact upon the person. But the emotional experience is a result of the true religious experience, which is essentially the knowledge of God. The more a person obtains insight into the wonders of God, that is the force which produces a certain type of an emotional connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The model that we're using is the model of tzitzis, the fringes on the garment, where the Torah says that you shall place them on the corners of your garments, and you shall see them, and you'll remember all of the commandments, and you will do them. So the tzitzis is extremely important, because it causes the person to remember the commandments. But the question that I'm asking is, how? How do fringes cause a person? What's the connection between fringes and the commandments? I'm not talking now about the tchelas, the blue dye, which Chazal say is through a process of association. It's the blue is the color of the sea, and then you think about what's above and the sky, and then you think about the fact that the Shekhinah, that God, the omnipresent, and so on and so forth. Even that is a very difficult idea, because when a person sees blue, they don't naturally associate all the way back to God. Because if that's the case, then anytime you saw blue, then that should be the preferred color. And also, if that's the case, then why is it only a certain type of blue that's achieved through the chalazon, a certain type of fish that existed, which we don't even have anymore. However, even so, we don't have the blue anymore, and still we maintain tzitzis. The tzitzis is a mitzvah. So we do it because of a custom. But nevertheless, one would imagine that that's the reason for the custom, because of the extreme importance that it has to cause us to remember the mitzvahs. But my question is, what is the relationship between fringes on the corner of your garment? How is it going to cause a person to remember the mitzvahs? It seems to me that the idea is that you're to designate something. It's a designation. It's not as a result of the fact that I'm commanding this to you, and you'll do the mitzvah, tzitzis. The performance of the mitzvah, tzitzis, will cause you to remember. How? Because you know what the tzitzis stand for. That's where God is designating this to be the thing which reminds you. It's a designated reminder. Not that it naturally functions this way in the world of nature, such that anybody who wanted to remember something significant would put fringes on their garments. It may tap into that in general, when people want to remember something, they may tie a knot around their fingers or things of that sort. So it tends to be a reminder. But you see, here it's in the context of the Torah. Because what is it? What am I supposed to remember? You're supposed to remember the most important thing. What's the most important thing? That you're created for a particular purpose, and your purpose is going to be achieved through the mitzvot. That's your whole life. Remembering the mitzvot and performing them. But again, it's because we're designating this. If there wasn't this designation, the Torah told you, this shall serve as a reminder. So now that I know that it serves as a reminder, so now when I see it, it'll serve as a reminder. Which came first? The mitzvah, which established it as a reminder. It's an established reminder. It's not a natural reminder. And the proof of this would be a person who knows that there's a mitzvah of tzitzis, but doesn't know the reason for tzitzis. That person maybe will perform it, like we perform any mitzvahs, even though we don't know the reason. That person will not get the benefit, because the person will not see the tzitzis and think of all the mitzvahs, and there's no natural connection between the two. This is a mitzvah which can only be performed if a person knows the reason for the mitzvahs, which again is a further proof that in order to fulfill the real benefit of the mitzvahs, you have to know the reasons, the tamei mitzvahs. If that's the case, I think we can understand what's happening over here. It's not far-fetched to say that the mandate, the Torah mandated a ramp. Instead of steps, not because in actuality going up steps would bring out certain kinds of thoughts or that it would be disrespectful to the place. It would not, because you're wearing pants, so you wouldn't have that problem. But it mandates a certain type of a behavior which is more in line with modesty. That is to say that immodesty is where you don't care, you just take big steps. And if it's a situation where you're not wearing pants, that would be immodest. So there's an association between that type of an approach and an immodest approach. We're talking about two approaches. In general, one can, that's why it's not arbitrary. The idea of not having steps is not arbitrary, because it could be associated with an immodest approach. Even though in this situation it would not be immodest. So therefore it seems to me that it's not so much the actuality of the steps itself, but the fact that you're restricted, you must have a ramp, that the law prevents you from having steps, that serves as a reminder. It's something which is built into the construction of the system. That's where the benefit is coming from. It serves as a reminder that in this particular place, one has to act in a completely different manner. One has to assume a different type of an attitude. And that attitude has to be one of seriousness. And that element of frivolousness that a person has, in general, has to be completely subdued. When a person enters into the Mikdash. Now let's take up this idea that Rashi says that these stones, even though the stones don't care, they're not even aware, still you shouldn't disparage the stones. That's the next step. That this is a prevention. The ramp is a reminder and it's a prevention against acting in a certain kind of a disparaging, degrading kind of a way. Which does show us that even when a person is going to a holy place, to the altar, to do the service of God, still has to be on guard against negative emotions, contrary emotions, rebellious emotions, which stem from the instinctual rebellious part of man, and even would allow the person to act out in very subtle ways, to act out their rebelliousness through certain gestures of disparagement. In my opinion, the phenomenon of talking in shul is an expression of this rebelliousness, this negation, or this degradation. That is to say that in most shuls, there's a serious problem. People can't be quiet. The din, there's a din very often. You can't hear the davening. And one wonders why it should be so. Even people that come late and only stay there for a half hour or an hour, it's not necessarily because it's too long. It's just, and even as soon as the davening is over on the way home, they may not have that much to talk about. It's a certain emotion. And I believe that that's part of it. The emotion is an expression of the resistance that they have. I mean, if they're in conflict, the fact they're in shul, I can say I have resistance. Well, if you will, I could say you have resistance, because you're not really in shul, you're just physically there, and you're doing everything to negate the activity that you're supposed to be involved in. It's a lack of respect for the holiness of the place. And that's very, very important. It's not just a matter of what people would say is decorum. That, I think, is the idea over here. It's a negation. When you act contrary to the ideal, it's a negation. You're saying there really is no such thing. There's denial. A person is denying. If a person were in the presence of God, truly believed they were in the presence of God, then they'd be in a state of absolute awe. So that a person has a conflict. They bring many conflicts to the service of God. And the instinctual side, which is the source of the conflict, is always looking for outlets. And it can be even subtle things. That's why the Torah, in my opinion, over here, went to such a great length to, even on something which seems to be trivial, and in reality, would be. As we've said, if a person actually walked up steps, the reality of it would not be a disparaging phenomenon, but to drive this point home, to make you aware of that, to be on the lookout for that type of a thing, that you should not allow yourself to express those emotions, the Torah insisted upon a ramp. It's an associative phenomenon. Now, what's the Kal Vachomer? Rashi says that there's a tremendous lesson to be learned from this in terms of how we should behave towards other people. And by the way, no pun intended, that is a bridge or a ramp between this and the and Mishpatim, because that's really what Mishpatim is founded upon. So I think that Rashi is saying that, well, actually there's two things over here. There's the personal, that a person should be in an appropriate state, should not, should get a hold of all their emotions, should not act in a emotional manner when they're involved in the service of God. And then this entails the avoidance of what's called a bizui, a degradation. So you have to have a certain reverence for the place, because the place is associated with the true ideas that pertain to God. But now Rashi is drawing a connection that if that is the case, that it's obligatory to avoid any type of abizui, that is to treat something with the proper respect. Now that's what we're talking about. And we have to have a concept in our minds about things, objects, that have to be related to from the standpoint of respect. If that's the case, then there is a certain inconsistency, so to speak, that people sometimes will display greater respect and lavish greater respect on a physical object, which is only representative of something else. It doesn't really experience any pain, and it's just essentially there for your own sake. How much more so when you're talking about the effect that your behavior has on something else, a different being, that is to say, a human being. A human being who's a Bitzelem Elokim, so that takes care, in other words, that is, the emotion of respect that you have towards the place should be because of its association with God. So which has a greater association with God? Something which is just stone, which has been built, or the human being who's Bitzelem Elokim? That's a greater association to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the first aspect, because Rashi's mentioned two different aspects which should affect us in terms of how we understand this analogy and how we treat people. He said two things. First of all, that this is a being which is B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God. And secondly, it cares about the pain. It feels the pain and it cares about the pain. So we have to understand both of these ideas. Both of the ideas are that, first of all, in terms of the factor which warrants our respect. And we said that there are certain different objects that we encounter that we have to act differently because of the associative phenomenon. They're more directly associated with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, with God. So you're talking about the Mikdash, that's very important. The Mizbeach is very important. That's associated with the service of God. So Rashi is saying, well, if that's the case, if the factor of reverence, and not to disparage, is because of the association with God, so what about a human being who's actually in the image of God? That's a greater representation, a greater manifestation, expression of the existence of the Creator. That's one thing. The second aspect is the practical effect. That is to say that whenever you consider how you're going to be behaving, what is the abstract, or the meaning of your behavior per se, what it reflects about you. That's more personal, the effect it has upon you, the statement that you're making. The second one would be the practical consequences. In the case of the Mizbeach, we're not concerned about the practical consequences. That's what Rashi is saying. The stones themselves don't suffer, they don't care, they don't have feeling. But if you disparage them, it's a breakdown in terms of the idea of God in your mind, because they're associated with the true idea of God. However, when you carry it over to a human being, so then how much more so should you treat a human being and respectfully and not to disparage, for two reasons. One is because of the element of God, the association to God is much, much greater, because the human being is created in the image of God. But secondly, there's the practical consequences. Here, you have a practical result, that this is a person who has feelings, who is aware of it and who cares about it and who's being hurt by it. So that's how much more so should you refrain from acting out your own natural instincts and emotions in a manner which would disparage that element in a person which causes them to disparage. How much more so when it comes to treating other people. This element in a person, this disparaging, this tendency to degrade things, it's there. Everybody has it. And it comes out in different situations. It comes out in situations with regard to the shul, for example, the synagogue, things that are associated with the service of God. That's one area in which it comes out. And of course that has a lot to do with the fact that there's a tremendous resistance. So when a person is thrust into those situations, one does have to be on guard against the unruly emotions that are there. And they will express themselves in subtle ways, which would be degrading. You're treating the place in a degrading kind of a manner. The other arena in which it comes out in would be you're dealing with other people. There's no question that there's a tremendous amount of aggression that people have towards others. Just take a look at the newspapers or TV. One of the most prominent things is when important people get involved in some kind of a calamity. When they commit a crime, when they're being thrown into jail, or the come down. When the mighty falls, so everybody can't get enough of it. Talking about it and going over it. And so, like it's almost like a tremendous celebration. That's part of our culture. To really enjoy the degradation of other people. Now, of course, there's all kinds of justification. Oh, this person was a multi-billionaire. This person was a great leader. This person was a great theologian or a great rabbi. You know, today, with the clergy, the whole issue with the crimes that are committed by clergy and things of that sort. Now, when these things happen, so they become public knowledge, and when they become public knowledge, it's not, to a certain extent, you can't avoid it. I mean, it's a public phenomenon. The public has a right to know, to protect itself. But that's not the point. The point is that there are people that get a tremendous amount of enjoyment and making fun out of these people, because then it becomes permitted to do so. Well, that's it. That's part of the penalty. So, the concern about the degradation of other people is not really foremost in most people's mind. They don't really have a genuine concern for the degradation of other people. But you see, Allah is very, very concerned with the degradation of man. You see that in the treatment of the deceased, even in the case where a person is given the death penalty by stoning, which is a very rare, very, very rare. But then, the body, it says that the person should be hung. The body is to be hung. But it's only for a few seconds, and you're not allowed to let the person hang overnight. Ki killas Elokim tolui. That is to say that is something which is degrading of God, because as Rashi says, it's the person who represents God, because of the divine soul. And that means that, of course, the responsibility is that the person should actually manifest its Elokim by the way they live. In a sense, all people reflect God because of the image, the human image. But in a sense, not all people do. I think that's the whole ambivalence with regard to the singing of Shira when the Egyptians were drowned in the sea. That the Malach Hasharis wanted to sing Shira. And they were rebuked because it's Masa Yoda, the works of my hand, are drowning in the sea. Which indicates that this is a loss, something that did not turn out in accordance with God's will. Because God gave man free will, so man can thwart God's will in that sense. But the Jews were permitted. That is to say that if a person lives improperly and lives like a human being, can destroy the divine image. It's all dependent upon how you live your life. And if you allow the instinctual to dominate you to the extent that you're just essentially in a very well advanced type of an animal, but not a human being that's living in control of your instincts, so then that's not really the human being. You've defeated the Tzelem Elokim. Well, the person who sinned, in a sense, that's what happened. But you have to show respect. Even though a person sinned, in a serious, very serious manner, and so that the body would be hung up. But it's, again, it's ambivalent, because on the one hand you have to do it to show how serious this is, on the other hand you know how to do it, because it does create a bizu shamayim. Any degradation of Adam is really a degradation of God. It's a negation of God. That's the idea that's coming through over here. And just like a person would negate God by acting in a disparaging manner towards the Mizbeach, towards the altar, how much more so by acting in a disparaging manner towards a fellow human being? The irony is that there are many, many people who have different approaches in the two different areas. It's sort of inverted. There are many people that are very, very respectful and show tremendous awe, reverence, say to a physical object, to a holy place, but don't carry it over towards the treatment of others. And conversely, a lot of people that are very, very solicitous at how they treat others, but they don't have the proper respect when they're in a holy place, a truly holy place. The problem is that it's not rooted in a genuine appreciation of the association between the person, the human being, or even the holy place, the association with the Creator. And there's a certain defect in a person's relationship to God and acceptance of the idea that in this framework, in this universe in which we find ourselves, that there are certain things that represent God, and the most significant of all of God's creation is that being which is the Tzelem Elokim. That's the whole, in the image of God, that's the whole foundation of the, what follows is Mishpatim. You see the link between the two. There's a tremendous link between the two. And that is Tzelem Elokim. That the treatment of one's fellow man falls under the heading of the religious responsibility, the relationship to God. In fact, the very first Rashi in Mishpatim, Rashi draws a connection between the building of the Mizbeach and the subject matter of Mishpatim, which deals with treating fellow men with restraint, with justice. It says, why are the two parshios brought together? To tell you, Shetasim Sanhedrin Eitzel HaMikdash, that you should establish a Sanhedrin next to the Mikdash. That's the juxtaposition. That is to say, that first you taught about the building of the sanctuary, which of course later on comes to be exemplified by the Beis HaMikdash, by the temple, and the law is that you can't have the Beis HaMikdash without the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, of course, is the ultimate Supreme Court, the place of justice. That is to say that you have to build the Sanhedrin in the Beis HaMikdash, which is an amazing idea. You can't separate the two realms. It's based upon this idea that this Rashi with the Kal V'Chomer explains the whole thing beautifully. And that is to say that the ultimate idea, the ultimate objective of the Mikdash is to bring you into the proper mode, the proper relationship with the Borei Olam, with the Creator. That's the whole source of all the awe that a person should have for the Mikdash. But if that's limited just to those areas, that type of thing, a person only feels, has that sense when he's in a holy place, but doesn't carry that over to fellow human beings and views fellow human beings in the same light, not just in the same light, but it's the contrary, that according to this, greater respect should be shown, if anything, to fellow human beings, because they're associated. That is to say, when it comes to that arena, the arena of dealing with others, and that evokes a whole new element in people, the competitive, the narcissistic, the egotistic, the aggressive. If a person is not able to overcome that set of resistances that are brought out in that realm and be able to treat fellow human beings with the same reverence because of the fact that that's the greatest bizui. The bizui is much greater when you degrade a fellow human being than even when you degrade a holy place. So then the person cannot have the appropriate relationship with God. The appropriate relationship with God has to permeate all the different areas in which a person deals with things that are associated with God.
House.
Or your own car. But you can't tell another person what to allow. Well, it's a business. It's your restaurant. You own it. You put up a sign. Smoking permitted in this restaurant. Everybody knows. And those who want to go to a restaurant where there's no smoking will find another restaurant. And the same is true of a person. The decision as to whether smoking should be permitted in any facilities should be made purely by those who own the facility. Unless it's a public facility. Public library, where you have to have rules that are objective. And what should be done over there is something else. Perhaps it's correct because it's bothersome to certain people, whatever, so to prohibit it in public facilities. Where you can't utilize the rule and say, this is the public library. You're not going to have another public library, so that's a different situation. But where it's a private facility, and it's an area where people exercise their choice, how can you interfere with people's rights? I am not saying it is right for people to smoke on airplanes, in closed places, where it bothers others. That is wrong. Shouldn't do it. The point I'm making is I can tell by the way people react, the offended parties react, with that anger and indignation, that it's an opportunity for aggression. That shows me that the objection to it is not based upon normal, reasonable, rational grounds. There are many other things that people do that offend, and it does not bring forth that type of a reaction. So, if I'm offended, if something is bothering me, then I'll point it out to the person. But I'm not going to go into this whole tirade. That is to say, one's reaction should be proportionate to the extent of the offense. And as I say, if you're standing on a street, a bus goes by, you have all this gas fumes, you know, from the exhaust, I don't see people going crazy. I don't see but one little cigarette, which has been out already for 15 minutes, and the person smells it, he goes crazy. How come he doesn't go crazy when he inhales all those fumes from somebody's exhaust, from a car? That, I say, it's because of a psychosomatic phenomenon. It's a hysteria. It's an induced hysteria. These are very strange times we're living in. People have fallen prey. People have very, very minimal self-knowledge. No self-knowledge at all. And they're looking for some type of sense of righteousness, not recognizing that it's really camouflaged for a lot of aggressiveness. And it produces a lot of these reactions. There is such a thing as psychosomatic reactions. And I think that this is something that should be looked into. To make the circle complete now, and to go back to the statement of Hillel, I do believe that this clearly refutes this notion of Basher. That's not what he said. He analyzed the situation. And we have to live our lives in accordance with the governing principles, the laws of nature. And the laws of nature are not just the impersonal ones, but in the human sphere as well. There are principles that determine the outcome of things. And it's extremely important for a person to have knowledge, to have objective knowledge, but also self-knowledge. And that ties in with what we're saying. Many people fancy themselves. They live their entire lives believing that they're saving the world, or that they're on a genuine crusade, when if they would analyze it, any shred of self-knowledge, they'd be able to see that this is a very powerful element of emotionalism, and to identify the emotions. Not to say that they shouldn't be involved in the cause. It could be that there's goodness in the cause. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying be aware. One needs to have self-knowledge. In order for a person to be genuinely involved in a true idealism, and I maintain that there really is hardly any true idealism in the world today. It's a very simple thing. People fool themselves, as I pointed out many times. People assume that they could just immediately jump into idealism without any real knowledge, without any study, without any thoughtfulness. You see that on the college campuses. That's today's hotbed of idealism. Go to any campus, they have all these clubs, all these protests, all these causes. Where did these
people who a couple of years ago were in high school, barely know anything. How'd they become such geniuses? And all of a sudden they have everything they know. They know about choice, they know about abortion, they know about gay rights, and everything under the sun. They're experts on oppression, on occupied territories. These are the geniuses. They know nothing. So apparently in America today, idealism has nothing to do with knowledge. How can you be an idealist? You haven't studied. You've got to study for many, many, many years to understand something. And what knowledge do you have about yourself? Your own emotions and your passions. How you're being fueled by these powerful passions. And this self-righteousness, this condemnation of everybody else. Like, you're pure. You're the ultimate in purity, moral purity. All these absurd. People are not idealists by nature. People are exceedingly, exceedingly selfish. That's how people are by nature. The only people that are really idealists are those who have spent many, many years. That's what Torah produces real idealism for those who grasp onto it. And they know that it's not easy. You've got to work many, many, many years and be objective and gain true knowledge. First you have to gain true knowledge. Then you have to gain self-knowledge and isolate your emotions and overcome your emotions. It's a very, very difficult process. Then you can have something that is akin to genuine idealism. But what you see in the world today is not genuine idealism. Because you can see all the elements of underlying hostility. It's an outlet. It's shabby, it's superficial, it's phony. And to the contrary, it's really an excuse for people to express their darker, sadistic impulses. In my opinion, this ending is a bit, I think it's on a positive note, but of course anybody listening will say it ends on a negative note. I say to the contrary, that in Judaism, the Rambam says that the purpose of Kol Torah Kul, the entire Torah, is to uproot and destroy idolatry. So the destruction of corruption, of false ideas, is a very positive phenomenon. If the point is correct, and I think it warrants research and looking into it, that there's a lot of misguided and phony idealism. I'm not saying people are deliberately or intentionally doing it. To the contrary, I'm saying they're not aware because they lack self-awareness. To the extent that people can remove themselves from this false approach, that's a very positive development. That's my general approach towards study, towards human improvement, and so forth. That's why I don't look at that type of a phenomenon to debunk something which is false. I think it's extremely important. This generation has not been raised with that idea because this generation is about political correctness. So there's no objective truth. So, you know, you have your thing, he has his thing, and why should you attack somebody else's thing? That's generally the reaction that my type of an approach will get. I don't believe that. I believe there is such a thing as objective truth. And there are many obstacles in the path of objective truth. And it's essential to point out falsehoods in myself. We're all liable and susceptible to that. So a significant element in advancement is the ability to recognize mistakes or certain emotions that are pervading your thinking processes. And once you free yourself, you liberate yourself from falsehood, that's a tremendous step forward, tremendously positive development, the way I look at things.